You're listening to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick.
I've been on the low, I've been taking my time. I feel like I'm out of my mind. It feel like my life ain't mine. Who can relate? Woo! I've been on the low, I've been taking my time. I feel like I'm out of my mind. It feel like my life ain't mine.
That was music from 1-800-273-8255. The song by Logic, Alicia Cara, and Khalid. A song bearing the name of the National Suicide Prevention Hotline that's received more than 250,000 views on YouTube alone. Sadly, three stories this week demonstrated suicide is prevalent. We learned fashion designer Kate Spade and celebrity chef and author Anthony Bourdain took their lives this week. And the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported suicides have risen 30% in our country since 1999. WKAR's Kevin Lavery reports on where you can go if you're thinking of harming yourself.
The deaths of fashion designer Kate Spade and chef and TV personality Anthony Bourdain just 3 days apart bring renewed attention to the suicide crisis. A report issued Thursday by the CDC finds Michigan's suicide rate rose by nearly one-third between 1999 and 2016. Pat Smith is the Violence Prevention Program Coordinator with the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services. She says people should not think that asking someone if they're considering suicide will lead to it happening.
It truly is a myth. Often people have said, you know, my best friend asked me if I was thinking about suicide, and she helped me get to help, and she saved my life.
The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline may be reached 24 hours a day at 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-TALK. Kevin Lavery, WKAR News.
Again, the National Suicide Prevention Hotline is 1-800-273-8255. 1-800-273-8255.
It's the very first breath when your head's been drowning underwater. And it's the lightness in the air when you're there chest to chest with the lover. It's holding on though the road's long, seeing light in the darkest things. And when you stare at your reflection, finding open.
Former Michigan State University Dean William Strample will now go on trial for charges that include sexual misconduct and willful neglect of duty. Capitol correspondent and former prosecutor Shayna Roth was in the courtroom for this week's preliminary hearing and joins me now. Hello, Shayna.
Hello, Reginald.
Did we learn anything new at the preliminary hearing?
Nothing sort of earth-shattering. We had gotten a lot of information ahead of the preliminary examination through the motions that were filed by the Attorney General's office. What was sort of compelling and interesting was that these women who are accusing Strample, they came forward, they sat on the witness stand, and they answered a lot of questions about what exactly happened. So we were able to flesh out some of those details. As the defense attorney noted, there was never a sort of, you know, blatant request for sexual favors from these women. But what they're saying is that we were in a room together. It was just the two of us. And he said these things that made me uncomfortable, that were very odd coming from him. So to actually hear these women explain what happened was very different than reading through the transcript.
In fact, we have some sound from a witness who described an encounter with Strample. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so the Attorney General's office asked that the names of the witnesses not be made public, so we're going to respect that. This is one of the witnesses who had one of these encounters with Strample. He said some inappropriate things to her, things that she interpreted to be requests for sexual favors. And this is how she explained, you know, kind of how that made her feel. Again, she was alone in this room with Strample, and she said, you know, it was me and him at this table, but he was between me and the door.
I was very scared. I instantly was, what is going on? Almost went into a survival mode, as there was no one in the room with us. There was no one in the adjacent room.
And again, I'm joined by Capitol correspondent Shayna Roth talking about William Strample going to face trial for sexual misconduct. We also know that Strample was Larry Nassar's boss. Nassar is the now imprisoned doctor who sexually abused hundreds of girls and women while at MSU. So Shayna, how will Strample's supervision of him be addressed at the trial?
So that's something that we don't really know a lot about yet, because this was the preliminary hearing, meaning that the Attorney General's office only had to show that there was enough evidence for trial on the felony and high court misdemeanor charges. And those charges were the criminal sexual conduct in the fourth degree and the misconduct of a public official. The charges that he's facing related to Larry Nassar, those are misdemeanors. So those were kind of going along with this case no matter what. And what we're probably going to see at the trial, if there is a trial, is we're going to have to see what exactly were these procedures that were supposed to be put into place. The Attorney General's office is going to have to prove that there were procedures put into place. And then they're going to have to, it's interesting, they're going to have to prove a negative. They're going to have to prove that Strample didn't do something.
You were in the courtroom for the preliminary hearing. Did Strample show any sort of emotion?
He was very stoic and very neutral, I would say, throughout the whole proceeding. You know, he didn't really seem to shy away from either the photographs that were shown or the witnesses that were testifying. But at the same time, he really didn't show any emotion.
Is there any evidence that won't be allowed into trial?
We're not sure yet. That will be decided by the circuit court judge, whatever evidence comes in at trial or not. What was interesting was during the preliminary examination, the AG's office said that they have this video taken from a camera that Strample allegedly installed or hid in his office. And the Attorney General's office said, look, this shows that he was trying to look at female students as they walked around his office or in and out of the area around his office. And the judge said, you know what, we're not going to allow that in. We don't really know exactly, you know, if he did have that camera in his office, was it actually hidden, why he would have it there, and what his purpose for it was. But that is something that the circuit court judge, if the Attorney General's office does decide to try to admit that evidence, that the circuit court judge could allow that in circuit court.
What is the process going forward?
This was all taking place in district court, and now he's going to kind of walk on over to circuit court, which is the felony court, and he's going to have to be arraigned all over again in circuit court, and then really it's just going to kind of go through the process. He's going to have a pretrial where basically his attorneys are going to sit down and see, you know, is the Attorney General's office willing to offer a deal? What does that deal look like? Is that something that Strample would accept? So it's still very possible that he could plead to some charges. It's very possible that he could go to trial. So really, we're kind of in a wait and see pattern as far as, you know, what is going to happen next. But he's really on his way towards going to a trial.
Well, thank you for updating us. That's our Capitol correspondent, Shana Roth, who's also a former prosecutor, bringing us up to date on the upcoming trial of former MSU Dean William Strample.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Current State from WKAR. With all the coverage of MSU, you may have missed that it's been determined that Michigan voters will decide this November whether to legalize use of marijuana for recreational purposes. Riley Began covers legislative issues for Bridge Magazine, and she joins us now via Skype. Hello, Riley.
Hey, Reginald.
Before we talk about what's going to be on the ballot, tell us, why did members of the state legislature want to pass their own marijuana initiative first?
Well, basically, we have a Republican-controlled legislature, and you might be surprised to think that they would want to pass marijuana legalization. And the reason that they expressed an interest in doing that was because they were concerned, and this is particularly Senate Republicans, were concerned that there wasn't enough regulation built into the petition as is to create basically a system that could be, you know, easily controlled and regulated once it becomes legal. So they were interested in setting up those regulations ahead of time while they basically can do it with a simple majority. This is a little bit of a technicality, but basically if it goes to the people in November, which it will now, to amend it after the people have voted on it, the state legislature would have to get a 3/4 majority to make any changes. So that's a pretty high bar. They thought, you know, let's get it out of the way now to do any of the amendments we want to do before, like, we would have to do a 3/4 vote on it.
And why did that initiative fail?
So it It was popular in the Senate, but in the House, they weren't able to muster the votes. So Speaker of the House Tom Leonard was personally opposed to marijuana, I mean, as are most Republicans in Michigan, or in the state legislature in Michigan. So Speaker Leonard was against it, and they basically weren't able to whip the votes among Republicans to get it done. So they decided to not vote on it, and it'll go straight to the people on November 6th.
And we're talking via Skype with Riley Began. She is outside, so you might be hearing some outside noise there. And she covers the state capitol for Bridge Magazine. Now on to November. Riley, what will Michigan voters specifically be deciding when it comes to marijuana?
So they are going to be deciding whether to legalize the possession and sale of marijuana for people over the age of 21. So it would be kind of similar to the way that we have alcohol legal for people over the age of 21 in this state. That marijuana could be taxed with up to a 10% excise tax and a couple other things around that. But the short answer is legalize recreational marijuana for people over the age of 21.
So Riley, what about possession of marijuana?
So it says in the language of the initiative that you're basically legally allowed to possess 2.5 ounces of marijuana. Anything over that looks like it would become a civil infraction, and there's some punishments laid out in the initiative around that as well.
How have attitudes about pot changed over the years?
You know, I don't have exact data on that, but it's a general understanding that Americans have become a lot more open to the idea of marijuana use recreationally over time. A Gallup poll recently showed that 65% of Americans believe that smoking pot is morally acceptable. And in Michigan, that number is pretty similar too. A recent poll showed that 60% of Michigan residents said they would vote yes on this initiative if it went to the ballot in November.
Have you heard of a campaign against legalization?
Yeah, there are actually two groups that are opposing this petition. One's called the Committee to Keep Pot Out of Neighborhoods and Schools, and the other is called Healthy and Productive Michigan. They both are opposing this initiative and will continue to campaign against it, I'm sure, through the fall. And, you know, that's something that Speaker Tom Leonard said when he was describing why the legislature decided to not take this up. Basically, he believes that over the next several months, once Michiganders get more information about marijuana and its effects on communities, that they would decide not to vote for it. So he's definitely, banking on that, it seems.
We've been talking with Riley Began, who covers the state capitol for Bridge Magazine. She joined us via Skype, and that's why we hear some of the outside noises there about how Michigan voters will decide this November whether or not to legalize marijuana for recreational purposes. Thank you, Riley. We know you're on assignment. Thanks for taking some time to talk with us.
Thanks so much, Reginald.
Our neighbor Canada may legalize marijuana as soon as this fall, and that means building a 1 million square foot pot greenhouse in the Great Lakes region. We'll have that story later in the hour. Coming up in our next segment,
next step in the process for me is boiling the egg noodles.
Our Serving Up Science team heads into the kitchen to tackle a Jewish dish. Imagine driving 1,600 miles before stopping for fuel. Meet the Michiganders trying to make that happen. Plus, from books to appliances to bicycles to furniture, find out why the MSU Surplus Store may be the place for you and your wallet. Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region, continues in a moment.
Food is the language everyone speaks, but do we truly understand it?
Between the conversations over organic food and GMOs, different diets taking the world by storm, and how what we eat actually impacts our environment,
there's no shortage of things to learn about. Hi, I'm Karel Vega.
And I'm Cheryl Kirschenbaum, and this is Serving Up Science. Welcome to Serving Up Science, the series all about food, where it comes from, and how it impacts our health and planet. I'm Cheryl Kirschenbaum.
And I'm Karel Vega.
And today we're continuing with part 2 of our recipe exchange. Last week, my family made Carell's mother's recipe for pozole. And Carell, first, why are we doing this?
Well, Cheryl, essentially, we wanted to show people that it's really easy to get used to the recipes you know, but by taking some samples from other cultures, you open a world of possibilities. And you gave me a recipe inspired by your Jewish heritage called kugel. Why don't you tell us about it?
Kugel is a traditional Jewish dessert or side dish. The word is Yiddish for sphere or ball, but sometimes people translate it to mean a pudding or a casserole. It's made from bread and flour, and the first ones were plain or salty rather than sweet. About 800 years ago, their flavor and popularity improved when cooks in Germany replaced bread with noodles or falafel and eventually incorporated eggs. Today, they've added cottage cheese and milk, and it has this delicious custard-like consistency, which is very common. So admittedly, I didn't give you the healthiest recipe, but I gave you a very tasty recipe.
All right, well, I did record myself cooking just like you did, or I should say baking. I don't know what you would consider, you know, the process of creating kugel, but here we go. This is how I did. All right, so I'm here in my kitchen now. I'm looking at the ingredients. The recipe for this kugel comes courtesy of smittenkitchen.com, the website. The link to that recipe will be posted on the WKAR website. I have the ingredients in front of my face now. It calls for 1 pound of wide egg noodles, 8 eggs, 2 cups of sugar, 2 pounds of full-fat cottage cheese, creamed or large curd, 2 sticks of melted unsalted butter or margarine, and 2 teaspoons of vanilla and a dash of salt.
All right, let's stop here just for a second to say you're hearing about all of these fats and a lot of salt, and obviously it's not, as I said earlier, the healthiest recipe. And if I'm going to be honest, most Jewish food isn't my favorite kind of cuisine. But for me, it's about feeling connected to my past, to my grandmother and my great-grandmother who sacrificed so much and lost so much in their effort to be a part of America and come to this country and survive. And in that way, when I'm eating the food that probably they had and we've had in our family for generations, it gives me that sense of connection. But I digress. Let's check back in and see how Carell did.
So step one of the process in making kugel: in a very large bowl, beat eggs. Here we go. Beat the eggs until fluffy. Doesn't seem too hard. I have a fork here. I'm going to do it old school style and just beat it with this big old fork. Let's do it. Doing this slightly out of order, but it doesn't really matter which way you do it. Next step in the process for me is boiling the egg noodles. First step in the process, filling up the pot. All right, water is boiling. It is time to add the egg noodles. Sounds about right. Maybe a little more. There's the oven.
I'm going to jump in here for a second to ask you, Carell, at this point, are you feeling confident about the recipe?
Of course I'm feeling confident. This is the easiest recipe I've ever seen. Although I must say, the cottage cheese aspect of it did throw me off a little bit. Also the noodles. I've never seen a dessert dish with noodles, and that did make me a little unsure, especially after I peeked into the oven about halfway through and I noticed that it was, you know, starting to char up. Starting to brown quite quickly. That made me a little scared.
Brown is a better description. I definitely don't think you should be charring kugel. Now, how does your kitchen smell at this point?
It smells sweet, like vanilla.
Like dessert?
I love it. All right, 1.5 hours later, we are ready to pull the kugel out of the oven. Let's see how we did. All right, and we have served ourselves a small piece of kugel to try out. The taste test begins. Here we go. I'm going to start with the crust. Extremely crunchy. I don't know if it's supposed to be like that. The inside looks a little more appetizing to me personally. So let's give that a shot. Oh, wow. Surprisingly good. It is really good. I'm finding this very tasty, mild, subtle. It's very subtle, very eggy, and I like that about it. Unfortunately, Cheryl, you weren't available to give my kugel a try the next day, but luckily I had some eager volunteers around the WKAR studios.
The texture is something that I can't really get my head around. Because I got a bit of the edge, so I got a bit of the crispiness that's in that noodle. And, God, it's got to be disgusting to hear me chewing and cottage cheesing around my mouth right now.
That's really sweet. It is, like, the consistency of mac and cheese, but it's sweet. I really like it.
I'd say it's sweeter than I had thought it would be. Not dessert sweet, not overpoweringly sweet, but... got a sweet quality that I kind of like.
So there's my attempt at making kugel. Cheryl, do you have any final thoughts on this little experiment of ours?
Well, by trading recipes, it gave us a chance to experience something new, and that's always good. You've been listening to Serving Up Science, the series all about food, where it comes from, and how it impacts our health and planet. I'm Cheryl Kirschenbaum.
And I'm Karel Vega.
And this is WKAR.
Listen every Wednesday during All Things Considered for Serving Up Science. That's from 4 to 7 p.m. on 90.5 WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. You're listening to Current State. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. Media mogul Oprah Winfrey once said, "What I love most about reading, it gives you the ability to reach higher ground and keep climbing." You're invited to climb with WKAR as we take part in the Great American Read. WKAR station manager Peter Worf is here with more.
This is the time of year when many of us pick out new books to read on summer vacation or visit the library with little ones home from school. Whether you're an avid reader or it's been a while since you've picked up a book and let your mind meander, we invite you to take part in the Great American Read. Last week, we talked with PBS President and CEO Paula Kerger about this program.
And the whole idea behind it is to identify America's most loved book. And we are hoping that it prompts debates and conversation and argument, hopefully not fistfights, over America's favorite book. Most importantly, to really get people excited about reading and talking about the books that have influenced their lives.
PBS President and CEO Paula Kerger talking about the Great American Read. It's an incredible list, which you can find at WKAR.org and also at PBS, The Great American Read. I'm talking with WKAR's Director of Education, Robin Pizzo, about this important project this morning on WKAR. It is an incredible list of books from the classics like Mary Shelley's Frankenstein,
yes,
and Jane Austen, Pride and Prejudice, 1984 by George Orwell. You have more contemporary works. A couple of my favorites, Prayer for Owen Meany,
yes,
by John Irving, John Kennedy Toole's Confederacy of Dunces, and some wonderful, more recent books like Gone Girl by Gillian Flynn and Suzanne Collins, one of the most popular series of the decade, the Hunger Games,
yes,
series. What are some of your favorites?
Well, you know, I'm really interested in reading The Prayer for Owen Meany. I did see that, and that's new to me. But because I have an affinity to children's and young adult literature, I'm just so excited to see some of great works like Charlotte's Web on the list. Ghost by Jason Reynolds is on the list.
Where do people vote?
So people can vote at pbs.org, Great American Read. You can also connect at wkar.org. And then also you can vote through the hashtag on Facebook and Twitter using hashtag GreatReadPBS.
Robin Pizzo is WKAR's Director of Education. Thanks, Robin.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to Current State from WKAR. One of the things holding back advancements in alternative fuel vehicles is their range. Nobody wants to run out of fuels like battery power, compressed natural gas, or propane. The alternative fuels group Greater Lansing Area Clean Cities is partnering with the U.S. Department of Energy on a project to enable traveling greater distances in these vehicles powered by something other than gasoline. WKAR's Scott Pohl explains.
What motivates a car buyer to choose an alternative fuel vehicle like the fully electric Chevrolet Bolt? Last week, I spent some time at Shaheen Chevrolet in Lansing to talk with Jaime McKnight in new car sales. He says these buyers are eco-friendly, well-educated, and have done their research on how to escape the addiction to oil. And with cars like the Bolt on the market, he thinks their numbers will grow.
I would say within the next 10 years, I'd say 75% of new passenger vehicles anywhere are going to be electric or some form of a hybrid system. So, you know, again, they're trying to be on that cutting edge.
The Bolt can go about 240 miles before needing to recharge. That's plenty for many drivers, but not nearly enough range for cross-country travel. The Department of Energy is trying to reduce or eliminate the gaps that prevent long-distance driving of alternative fuel vehicles with a project called U.S. Fuels Across America's Highways, Michigan to Montana. What they're hoping for is that one day an alternative fuel vehicle will be able to drive the entire 1,600 miles of Interstate 94 from Port Huron, Michigan to Billings, Montana. Greater Lansing Area Clean Cities is seeking partner applications for the project through the end of the month. Coordinator Jeremy Orr.
It's a Department of Energy-funded project started in January 2017. The grant deal is Gas Technology Institute out of Chicago, Illinois. And it's Gas Technology Institute along with the Greater Lansing Area Clean Cities and other Clean Cities coalitions across the Upper Midwest, from Wisconsin, Illinois, Minnesota, North Dakota, and even Teton-Yellowstone Clean Cities Coalition. We're looking at I-94 from Port Huron, Michigan to Billings, Montana, and identifying critical gaps in alternative fuels infrastructure, meaning electric vehicle infrastructure, DC fast chargers, compressed natural gas, and propane.
Along with filling in the fueling option gaps, the project aims to promote alternative fuel vehicle usage to the point where providing these fuels is attractive. Signage showing motorists where fueling stations are located is critical, in part, so that people thinking about buying an alternative fuel vehicle are reassured that there's less risk of running out. Orr has hopes that the Michigan Department of Transportation will deploy fueling option signage this summer.
We've been working pretty closely with them. And what that's going to do, it's going to allow consumers to know, hey, if you want to buy Bolt or whatever it may be, you can charge here. And so it kind of gives them that, it's called range anxiety. It kind of helps alleviate the range anxiety of knowing where can I charge.
Orr says Southeast Michigan has a pretty well-established system of fueling stations, but there are gaps along I-94 in the state where it's hoped that this project would help.
If you go back to the Alternative Fuels Data Center and look at where stations are, Western Michigan's pretty barren for the most part. Depending on the fuel, if you look west of Ann Arbor or Jackson, it's pretty barren. And so we're looking for partners now to help deploy infrastructure.
This $5 million DOE grant-funded project is in its early stages. Along with Michigan, groups similar to WARS in Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin, Minnesota, North Dakota, and Montana are also looking for fueling station partners. Ultimately, there would be no more than 50 miles between stations. If that happens, you'll be able to plug into a DC fast charger near the Blue Water Bridge in Port Huron and take that road trip to Billings. If it works on I-94, alternative fuel proponents like Jeremy Orr would foresee expansion along other American highways. For WKAR News, I'm Scott Pohl.
You're listening to WKAR's Current State. Most of Michigan State University's students have left for the summer, and much of the campus is quiet. But for the MSU surplus store, it's the busiest time of the year. WKAR's Katie Cook paid them a visit to see what things are like during move-out madness.
Come spring, the MSU surplus store and recycling center has their work cut out for them.
It is an absolutely crazy time of the year. We moved over 1 million pounds this last year to the landfill as well as to surplus store and recycling center and the various recyclers around the state.
Operations manager Sean Barton speaks with energy and excitement when he talks about what his collections team was able to bring in this year. Almost everything they get comes from driving around campus and picking it up themselves.
The Friday of move out, we do continuous laps, and I actually put extra trucks on the road. Typically, we pick up about 5,000 pounds per stop, and we'd go 7-8 times in a day to a single spot.
When the mission is to save as much as possible from going to the landfill, you get quite a variety of random things for sale at the surplus store.
We have lots of carpets. We roll them on the outside. We measure them and tag them that way you don't have to unroll them to make sure so you know that this is a 12 by 12 or this is a 16 by 18 or whatever size it is. We get a lot of mini fridges, a lot of fans. The thing I see the most on the sales floor right now is shower caddies. And that's something we try to market towards incoming freshmen is, hey, you don't need to go out and buy a piece of plastic, essentially, because that's what a shower caddy is. We've got them here for a dollar right now, as opposed to they're probably 10 or 20 bucks brand new, and they're all the same, to be honest. And ours, you might just need to run through your dishwasher or wash it by hand, and it's good to go, and you're doing a great thing by reusing an item that otherwise would just be recycled.
And you've probably heard of their famous bike sales.
For bikes, it's usually a bigger, bulkier item. And a lot of people say, you know what, we'll just leave it on the rack and I'll come get it in the summer. And unfortunately, that's not something that's allowed. So they sit on the racks for about 30 days as being tagged as abandoned. And after 30 days, they're impounded for 30 days. And then they come to us. Last move out, we picked up about 1,200 bicycles. So that's an awful lot of bicycles when you really start thinking about how much, I mean, that's 6 semi-trailers filled with bicycles from just 1 year. And we have them all right now on our sales floor. I think we have about 600 left, and we have to be ready in July for another 1,200.
Barton takes me behind the scenes to see where everything is sorted. He's surprised by how much clothing they got this year.
Clothing is something that we pick up a lot more than you would think. So we get a lot from international students. International students are specifically at a disadvantage because typically you can only take one or two suitcases home on a plane, which means you're leaving a lot of the stuff that you got here. So luckily, we have a good pack-up pitch-in program. We're in the lobby. You have a chance to divert your clothes and that sort of stuff.
The part of the facility where everything is dumped and sorted is a giant warehouse with conveyor belts and huge bunkers.
Everything that you put in a recycling bin on campus is touched by a hand on the sort line by a student. So when you're doing that and when you're recycling, think about that, that if you got a bag that's kind of mixed with all the recycling in that, well, trash is just unsorted recycling. As it is, please, you know, do your best. Don't just throw a whole bag of mixed recycling in there. We have to open up that bag and hand sort it on a sort line with the conveyor belt. Doesn't stop. It keeps moving. And you could miss other things, and more stuff could result in other contamination, which results in less being recycled and isn't necessarily best practice.
On a walk through the sales floor, we see everything from hair dryers to Christmas trees. And on the way out of the building, Barton points to the free area that's full of futons. And he shows me some playground equipment that he's especially excited about.
Oh, here's another coolest thing from Spartan Village. You know, as they're decommissioning, they're doing playground. They had playgrounds, so we've been selling it. And I believe we sold that fire truck playground piece of equipment to a fire station around here so they can put it in their front yards for kids to go and play on. So I love that story of reuse. You know, that's something that just makes me say, yay, sustainability, yay, MSU. We were able to do something cool and keep, you know, resources out of that landfill. And that's, again, what we're all about.
Yeah, and something like that, when it's a perfect fit like that, that's got to feel good.
Yeah, it is. That was just a perfect, like, yeah, the person that needed that got that item, which is great.
To find out more about the MSU Surplus Store and its hours of operation, visit WKAR.org. I'm Katie Cook.
Vietnam. Riots in American streets. Assassinations of leaders. 50 years ago, American life could be described as chaotic. Coming up, Michiganders remember Bobby Kennedy. When Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region, returns. Welcome back to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Reginald Hardwick. 50 years ago this week, Robert F. Kennedy died after being shot in Los Angeles. For many, he seemed on his way to the office that his brother, John F. Kennedy, held when he was assassinated 5 years earlier. Burl Schwartz, owner and publisher of Lansing City Pulse, remembered Bobby Kennedy, with WKAR's Scott Pohl.
March 16, 1968. Amidst the national turmoil over the Vietnam War, Robert Kennedy announced he would challenge fellow Democrat President Lyndon Johnson. Here's some audio from CBS News.
I am announcing today my candidacy for the presidency of the United States.
A couple of weeks later, college student Burl Schwartz would cross Bobby Kennedy's path in Philadelphia.
I was working on my college newspaper as an editor, and I was alone in the office on a Saturday, and I answered the phone, and the caller identified himself as an advance man for Bobby Kennedy's presidential campaign. He said Kennedy was coming to Philadelphia to campaign in the Pennsylvania primary, and wanted to give a speech at the University of Pennsylvania and was looking for someone to help identify a location.
Schwartz wound up helping the campaign arrange a speech at the famous basketball arena, the Palestra. At the event, he introduced Congressman Bill Green, who introduced Kennedy.
Well, afterward, very nervously, I asked him as he was listening, standing there absorbing the applause, if he would sign the book. He said, wait, you know, and he just kept looking at the crowd. And then finally he said, yeah, I'll sign it.
As you might expect, Schwartz still has that autographed copy of To Seek a Newer World. Before long, LBJ would shockingly withdraw from the race.
I shall not seek, and I will not accept, the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
And as his bid for the White House gathered steam, on June 5, 1968, Kennedy was shot after winning the California Democratic primary. He would die about 26 hours later. Here's how ABC covered the shooting.
My thanks to all of you, and now it's on to Chicago, and let's win there. Thank you.
Senator Kennedy has been shot. Is that possible? No. Is that possible? It's good. Is it possible, ladies and gentlemen? It is possible. He has. Not only Senator Kennedy. Oh, my God. Senator Kennedy has been shot.
Burl Schwartz was watching the TV coverage that night.
Immediately got a phone call from a friend of mine who was as conservative as I was, probably liberal at that time, but he knew how much Kennedy meant to me. And I remember it well.
Schwartz was invited to represent the college press at Robert Kennedy's funeral, notable for many reasons, including brother Ted Kennedy's eulogy.
Those of us who loved him and who take him to his rest today, pray that what he was to us, what he wished for others, will someday come to pass for all the world.
Schwartz rode the train that carried Kennedy's body from New York to Washington for burial at Arlington National Cemetery.
You don't think of these things when you're dealing with such national figures, but the sight of seeing Ted Kennedy take dirt and crumble it on his brother's coffin is something that I'll never forget.
Read more of Burl Schwartz's Bobby Kennedy story in this week's edition of his paper, Lansing City Pulse. Scott Pohl, WKAR News.
Someday, soon, is gonna be one day. I thought I saw him walking up over the hill, Abraham and Martin and John.
Robert Kennedy's death on this week, 50 years ago, came only weeks after he campaigned for the presidency in Detroit. Quinn Kleinfelter reports for our fellow NPR member station WDET, and he says Kennedy left an impression and a void that some in Metro Detroit say lingers to this day.
At a Detroit park on the corner of what was once 12th Street and Claremont, a man glances around, noting it's the site that sparked 3 days of violence in 1967. Back then, Andy Sachs was a young photographer for the Michigan Daily student newspaper, and one of several journalists who crammed into Robert Kennedy's motorcade as he campaigned in Detroit in the spring of 1968. Sachs says after a few stops, the motorcade purposely targeted this intersection, an area many at the time said was one of the most dangerous in Detroit. Kennedy perched atop an open convertible and was quickly surrounded by an adoring crowd.
As a photographer, I could get pretty close to him. When he reached out to shake someone's hand, they really give it a big tug, and I saw him start to lose his balance and begin to fall into the crowd. I just put down my camera and reached out with one of my hands and grabbed a hold of his shoulder and pulled him back up. He had no bulletproof vest, none of that kind of protection, but he did have someone of his campaign crew holding him around the waist so he wouldn't be pulled out of the car.
Sachs calls it a surreal sight, the vestiges of violence still visible in a neighborhood filled with happy people cheering one of the most famous politicians in the country.
I'm just amazed at how many people were on the street and the kind of celebratory atmosphere. He was plain speaking. Sure, he was a rich guy from Boston, but he seemed to have a vision of government and the way it should interact with the whole of the population of the United States. He connected with inner city people.
After President John Kennedy's assassination in 1963, Brother Bobby became a champion of the civil rights movement.
How can you go arrest somebody if they haven't violated the law?
They're ready to violate the law.
Could I suggest that the sheriff and the district attorney read the Constitution of the United States?
Such comments led to threats of violence against the brother of the slain president. And another young photographer in that 1968 Motor City motorcade, Jay Cassidy, says those threats followed Robert Kennedy to Detroit.
The first stop on the trip was Cadillac Square, the downtown square, and there was a huge crowd there. That's where the group that was called Breakthrough, which was a sort of a hate group that arrived with signs, "Give us your blood, Bob," all of it.
No, if we could get to Mr. Kennedy, he offered to donate blood to the Viet Cong. So we consider that a man in a position he's in, a senator of the United States, that says that he wants to donate blood to the enemies of this country and the murderers of his brother, then we think he should donate all of it. There's people willing to take that blood and send it to the Viet Cong, all of his blood.
Those remarks are from members of the group in Detroit in 1967, when they first trailed Kennedy to a Jefferson Jackson Democratic Party event at Cobo Hall. Though he was about a year away from declaring his bid for the presidency, Kennedy had already honed his message that the U.S. could not be judged a strong nation simply because it was the wealthiest country on earth.
For the gross national product includes air pollution and advertising for cigarettes and ambulances to clear our highways of carnage. It counts special locks for our doors and jails for the people who break them. The gross national product swells with equipment for the police to put down the riots in our cities. Still, it goes up as the slums are rebuilt on the ashes.
By 1968, Kennedy's mere presence was something of a tonic at times. He calmed a mostly African-American crowd in Indianapolis the night Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was murdered, then intended to put his campaign on hold until after the funeral. But civil rights activists pleaded with Kennedy to keep a scheduled appearance the next day in Cleveland and present a message of nonviolence as cities across the country burned in the wake of King's death. Kennedy responded with a speech that was in many ways an indictment of American society.
For there is another kind of violence, slower, but just as deadly, destructive as the shot or the bomb in the night. This is the violence that afflicts the poor, that poisons relations between men because their skin has different colors. This is the slow destruction of a child by hunger and schools without books and homes without heat in the winter.
Kennedy had rarely addressed the death of his brother John, but on this day, after Dr. King was killed, Kennedy's words defined what he called the mindless menace of violence.
When you teach that those who differ from you threaten your freedom or your job or your home or your family, then you also learn to confront others, not as fellow citizens, but as enemies. But we can perhaps remember that those who live with us are our brothers, that they share with us the same short moment of life, that they seek, as do we, nothing but the chance to live out their lives in purpose and in happiness. Surely this bond of common fate can begin to teach us something.
Back at the site of the start of the 1967 Detroit Rebellion, photographer Andy Sachs stares five decades into the past. Sachs was barely in his 20s then, but by early June of 1968 had already seen the assassination of a president and a civil rights icon. Then came the news of an assassin's bullet fired at Robert Kennedy in California, and Sachs says he feared he'd finally seen the death of a dream.
I wasn't so shocked when I heard that Robert Kennedy had been killed. I just sort of said, okay, this is America, isn't it? It was sad. I mean, I still kind of get emotional about it because we looked at him as a hope, you know, for the country. And that hope was gone after he walked into that hotel kitchen in Los Angeles.
Sachs says he wonders if there will ever be another politician with Robert Kennedy's ability to inspire people to, in the words of Abraham Lincoln, seek the better angels of our nature. Robert Kennedy, by all accounts, was not a saint, but he called for unifying all segments of the U.S. populace, and there appear to be few ready to shoulder that mantle in these bitterly divided political times. I'm Quinn Kleinfelter.
Earlier in this broadcast, we told you that a proposal to legalize recreational marijuana in Michigan will be on the ballot this November. Canada is also moving to legalize recreational use of pot, and officials say it could happen this fall. As suppliers gear up for the change, a 1 million square foot pot greenhouse is being built near Lake Ontario. Angelica Morrison from our reporting partner, Great Lakes Today, takes us to the town of Niagara-on-the-Lake, which has been best known for wineries and a summer theater festival.
Take a drive through the picturesque landscape of Niagara-on-the-Lake, and you'll see acres of vineyards, farms, and wineries. You'll also find a greenhouse containing one of the largest marijuana farms in the world. And if you're standing close enough, maybe just a few yards away from the building, you could smell weed. Inside the greenhouse, a tour is starting. We get a peek at the growing room. Hundreds of lush green plants and pots lined in rows under very bright growing lights and large fans positioned near the ceiling.
At this facility, you can see we put in blackout curtains and lights so we can actually trick the plants into flowering when we want it to flower.
That's Mark Zuklin, president of Canopy Growth Corporation, Tweed's parent company. He's talking about the growing process.
We have more crop cycles out of this facility, which obviously improves our output, but also from a staffing perspective.
Canopy is wrapping up a greenhouse expansion from 350,000 square feet to 1 million. That's about the size of 22 football fields to accommodate the growth of recreational and medicinal marijuana. But this expansion has some in this quaint tourist town concerned. The town is just about 13 miles from Niagara Falls. It's known for a theater festival named for George Bernard Shaw. Town Councilor Betty DeCiro worries that the marijuana industry could take over valuable land used for specialty crops like wine grapes.
So it would seem to me logically that you want to save your specialty crop land to grow food.
The province of Ontario has earmarked the Niagara Peninsula for growth of tender fruit and grapes. Last September, DeCiro called for increasing regulatory protection for land where specialty crops grow.
We could end up with multiple marijuana greenhouses on an area that tenderfruit should be planted.
About 15 kilometers away from the greenhouse, tourists meander through the Heritage District visiting shops and restaurants. Some, like Lado Bertich of Mississauga, are concerned about the pot farm getting bigger.
It can change the look and feel of Niagara-on-the-Falls, as we know.
Others, like Roberto Delmas of Mississauga, is among the tourists who say the huge marijuana greenhouse won't change the area.
No, I don't think so, actually, because most of the people that come here is middle-aged, seniors. So they may enjoy it, a puff here and there, but I mean, I don't think it will change.
Some in the area are also worried about marijuana's dank smell. The thick skunk scent has been an issue in U.S. states like Colorado and Vermont. And in Niagara-on-the-Lake, the owner of one winery told the town board that he's concerned about his vines. He says they might absorb the aroma and show the smell of marijuana over time. Another neighbor, Paul Kent of Kent Heritage Farms, has been up the road from the pot farm for years and hasn't noticed a stench.
Other than there seems to be a lot of cars parked there now, it doesn't impact me in any way, shape, or form.
Jordan Sinclair, spokesperson for the pot greenhouse, says folks shouldn't worry at all about the smell because they have carbon scrubbers that manage the exhaust.
It is an encased facility, so I don't think that there's any possibility that, you know, the cannabis, the smell of it could permeate grapes and change the outcome.
He's not the only one who thinks growing marijuana here makes sense. Alan Unwin is with Niagara College Canada. The school has a new marijuana growing curriculum, and Unwin says pot is a perfect fit for the region's established greenhouse industry.
So a lot of our greenhouse complexes here
have shifted towards cannabis and growing cannabis legally for both the medicinal and the recreational industries.
Canadian pot was set to be legal for recreational use by July, but some officials speculate that it will be much later. This is Angelica Morrison.
And that's it for this edition of Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. For the entire WKAR News team, have a great weekend. We'll connect with you again next week.